My name is Jim Miller. I'm a grateful recovering Al-Anon. I want to thank the committee for inviting Christy and me to speak this weekend. I want to thank them for allowing us to bring our family with us. And that's been a real joy. We are the Millers. John broke our anonymity and gave our last name up here, so in case anyone's wondering. And since he did that, I'm going to ask John, who is responsible for my children this weekend? Said everyone but us. We're going to talk to you about that, and that's. but it's been wonderful. As soon as Christy and I walked in last night, we just said that there was a warmth that we could feel, and I've been to several of these conventions in my 15 years in Al-Anon, and some of them have a warmer feel. They're all special, but some of them have a warmer feel than others. And Christy and I had been down to the Gulf Coast Roundup, several years ago when it was in Panama City, and we thoroughly enjoyed it then and not been back, and just so grateful that we were able to be invited here. But as soon as you walked in, we said, yeah, this has a special feel. And I know that when this many people will gather on Friday morning when we're at the beach and the sun's beginning to shine outside, that either some of you are very dedicated to recovery, or the really sick one showed up. It's been kind of a family. I do want to kind of tell y'all, introduce the family. Not everyone's here, but I'm not going to ask people to stand up. But Christy, my wife, you'll be hearing speak tomorrow morning for those of you who choose to come. We have two daughters with us right now, our 10-year-old Jessica, and then Katie, who has turned 13 today and is embarking on 7 years. 7 years of being a teenager. That's the primary reason why we decided to make this a family weekend, because we didn't want to be away on her birthday. So we brought her with us. Ray, our 16-year-old, will be coming in later on this afternoon. We did get the others out of school, but she felt she needed to go to school today. She'll be in it a little late this afternoon, along with one of our two adopted sons. Bobby is here. And he's one of our adopted sons in the family. He's been in the program for a number of years. And then John will be coming in with Ray. He's another semi-adopted son in the program. Both of them have joined our family through the program. They are like sons. Christy and I only make girls, so I had to go out and find a couple of sons to complete the family. And as I came in and saw the theme of this convention, Love and Be Loved, you'll find that I'll talk about loving and being loved during my talk, and it's an important part of my usual message. And so if there's a theme for a convention and I'm asked to speak, sometimes I try to say a little something about the theme. And today I don't have to change anything about what I usually say, because that is the program. The 12 steps are a method of teaching us to love, and how to love ourselves, and how to allow others to love us. And that's what the 12 steps are about, as far as I'm concerned. The family that we've had and that we brought with us this weekend is really only representative of what the Al-Anon and AA has meant to our family, because in recovery, what we have been able to do, or what I've been able to do, and what Christy and I've been able to do together, is to become more open, loving people. Our house is open quite often. We say that there are more people. We aren't sure who has keys to our house nowadays. There are people let themselves in, and the only requirement is that whoever gets there first fixes a pot of coffee, so that whoever gets there next has one. And it's a joyous way to live. It's a very loving way to live, and it's something that has brought just tremendous, tremendous joy to our home. There are times when we've been concerned about the number of people in the program who are in and out of our house, and the time that we spend in the program, and whether or not this has been in some ways detrimental, because yes, we only do have 24 hours of time a day, and we do have children of our own who we need to spend time with. But you see, what we have found is that in almost all cases, as other people in the program come into our lives, is that they also give time to our three daughters. And I think it has helped to make their life more special and more loving. I reminded of what someone told me one time, because I was complaining that I didn't have enough time. and that I was had didn't have enough time for this or didn't have enough time for that. And this woman looked right at me and she said, "Jim," she said, "yeah, you're wrong." She said, "That's one thing that we all have equally. Everybody has 24 hours a day. It's how we choose to use it. You know, don't complain about not having enough time. That's one thing we all have equally." And I try to remember that today, because at times in a busy life, yes, it is. Time is important, and how we choose to spend it is important. But our ODAT says that our children are one of the first things that should come first, and one of the reasons we decided to bring them with us this weekend. Sometimes we Al-Anons are criticized as being a rather humorless lot. my home group, which is a Star Mount Al-Anon group in Columbus, Georgia, and I think it's the best home group in the whole world. Where we used to meet was kind of down the hall from where the Star Mount AA group met, and we couldn't hear what they had to say in there. But sometimes if they had a lot of laughter, we could hear them. Or at the end, if the chips were being given out, you know, we could hear the clapping. We'd realize a chip was being given out, and we could hear laughter from there, you know, several times. And I will admit that probably laughter did not occur in our room quite as often. But when we did have a roar of laughter from our room, there were a lot of AAs who looked real curious after the meeting. They were always a little concerned and a little worried about who we were laughing about or what we were saying. So I always like to tell a couple of Al-Anon jokes, because if I don't, I'm afraid some AA speaker will come up and tell them. But one of my favorites is that you've heard the light bulb jokes. You know, how many psychiatrists does it take to change a light bulb? Only one, but the light bulb has to really want to change. And you know how many Al-Anons it takes to change in a light bulb? It says really none. It says the Al-Anon will just step back and tell the light bulb to screw itself. But my favorite really is how you can tell an Al-Anon, you know, about when an Al-Anon knows they're about to die. Someone else's life flashes before their very eyes. I did grow up in an alcoholic home in Manchester, Georgia, a small town of about 5,000 in rural Georgia, just about 35 miles from Columbus, where Christy and I live. My father was a professional man. He was a dentist, and his life and our family life gradually changed through his alcoholism. Eventually, when I was about 14, my parents divorced. And my father was not a violent alcoholic. He was the kind of alcoholic who came home, got drunk, went to bed, and went to sleep. And that was about it. So the problems in my family was just the fact that at a time in my life when I needed him, he was not there. On the day that I graduated from high school, he returned from what was treatment for him, which was about a 2-month stay at Dr. John Mooney's house in Statesboro, Georgia, and he was sober for 5 years before he died. A very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. During that time when his drinking was affecting our lives, I look back through that time and see that I look back at the young man that I was then, and there's some things about him that I don't like very much. I don't really sit down and say, you know, how much of this was because my father was an alcoholic or how much wasn't, but I just know how I was back then. As you see, we lived in one of the largest houses in Manchester, probably the largest house in Manchester at that time. And I mean, when you're from a town of 5,000, that doesn't mean a lot. Yeah. But I knew it was one of the largest houses. And my father's alcoholism, through the divorce, we lost that large house. And we had to go move into a house about 3 blocks down the road, same general neighborhood, nice area of town, but it was not one of the largest houses. And I was embarrassed. Because you see, somehow I thought I deserved to live in the biggest house. I remember before the divorce that finances must have already, I didn't realize, must have already been a problem. But my father had, it was the year that the Ford Galaxy LTD was first coming out. And the Ford Galaxy LTD, there was this huge media campaign about it. I mean, I can hear the commercials today. It was going to be quieter than a Rolls Royce. Top of the line Ford. It was wonderful. And we were going to get a new Ford. And I was excited because, you see, I knew that I deserved to live, to ride around in top of the line. And my father drove up the new car, very proud of this. and all he had was the Ford Galaxy. He didn't have the top of the line LTD. And I was 12 years old and I was angry. Because you see, somehow I felt like I deserved the very best. Now I'll tell you that when I look back at that young man, I'm a little disgusted, because you understand, the very last thing today that I would pray to God for is, God, please give me what I deserve. You know, so much would be taken away. Life today is so good. Life today is so good. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't problems in my life today. That doesn't mean that I don't have pain in my life today, anger problems. Yeah. But life is so good today. Yeah. You know, so much would be taken away. God has given me, in His grace, has given me so much more than I deserve. I grew up in that alcoholic home. My father did get sober. I went away to college, to Duke University. And there I met Christy, my wife, who was also a student at Duke University. And we had a good time there. We partied hard, we played hard, we studied hard, and we fell in love. And it was a beautiful love story. We fell in love. It's a wonderful thing. We've been together for over 20 years now, and I'm really grateful for that gift in our life today. It was during this time that my father, I first began to learn something about Alcoholics Anonymous. My father had given me a big book, and I read the big book to try to understand his disease. And I did read that, and I had the big book up in my college dorm room at Duke University, and on several occasions people would ask me about it, and I was amazed, and they'd ask me why I had it there, and I'd tell them that my father was a recovering alcoholic, and on several occasions I had people say, well, my father's an alcoholic too, not recovering. And I had no recovery to share with them, but at least I had some identification that I could share with them. And at least they saw that and I could tell them that my father had gotten sober through Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, simply because I had the book on the shelf. Simply because, you know, I was willing to answer a question. And I don't know whether or not anything ever came of that, but I like to think that perhaps that someone at some time in their life, when it was necessary, may have got some help either for themselves or helping a loved one get help. I'm sure that some of my fraternity brothers at that time are in AA today too. During that time at Duke, I came home one summer, as I did each summer, in order to work at Callaway Gardens, and I spent some time with my mother and some time with my father. And one July night, my father called me outside of the little apartment that he was living in at that time, and we were sitting in this driveway, kind of leaning against his car. And looking up at the stars. And as I remember that July night, there were more stars in the sky than there have ever been before or since. It was a beautiful, beautiful night. And my father asked me, he said, Jim, you remember when I was down at Dr. John Mooney's, a letter you wrote me? And I remembered the letter very well, because I'd had a very difficult time, because I didn't know what to say, didn't know what to do. But in that letter, he reminded me, and I remembered, I'd said, Dad, I love you because that's how any son should love their father. But I do not respect you. He was about 2 years sober at this point. He said, Jim, he said, I'd like to know, have I gained your respect back? And I said, well, Dad, haven't I shown you that? Haven't I, in our talks about what have gone on, haven't you seen that I respect you? And he says, yes, Jim, but I want to hear the words. And I said, yes, Dad, of course I respect you. And he said, good, because I still have that letter in the top drawer of my chest of drawers, and I'd like to tear it up. And then looking back at that night, I realized that really what happened in some small way or in some great way is that he made an amends to me and I made an amends to him, even though at that time I didn't know that's what was happening. And I thought of that conversation quite often since that time, because there's a statement in our ODAP that says that every person deserves our respect simply because they're a fellow child of God. The alcoholic deserves our respect simply because they're a fellow child of God. But you see, I had respect and admiration confused. Yes, I did not admire my father's alcoholism. I did not admire the problems that had come into his life and our lives because of his alcoholism. You see, but today I hope that I have learned that every person, drunk or sober, dry or in recovery, earth person or recovering person, deserves my respect simply because they are my brother or my sister, a fellow child of God. You know, when I can remember that, I'm doing pretty well. When I can remember that, I'm doing pretty well. Christy and I got married. Well, yeah, I graduated from Duke University and went on to a year of medical school. She was a year behind me, finished up her nursing degree at Duke University, and after she got her degree, we got married. We did things the right way. I always did things the right way. I was, good hero child in that family. And we waited till she graduated, and when we got married. And I remember on the night before we got married at our rehearsal dinner, I toasted to the woman who taught me how to love. Yeah. I was 23 years old, thought I knew something about love, and thought Christy had taught it to me. I was a confused young man. and we embarked on this adventure of marriage and the adventure of life together. And you see, we thought we had the perfect marriage. We thought we had the perfect friends. We thought we were going to have the perfect life. We had the perfect opportunities. Everything was going to be perfect and everything was going to be wonderful. Right? And we got through medical school pretty well, and we went out to Dallas, Texas for me to do my internship and residency in internal medicine. And that's pretty rigorous. I was at Parkland Hospital, big city hospital, very rigorous training program in internal medicine. And for those 3 years of internship and residency, my schedule, for the most part, went like this. I was at the hospital for 36 hours, spent the night there, came home, spent 12 hours, went back to the hospital for 12 hours, came home for 12 hours, and then started the cycle again, spent 36 hours at the hospital, in the hospital every third night. And that's about the way that it went for most of the 3 years. There were some breaks in there, but that was most of it. And you see, but this didn't matter. Because you see, Christy and I had the perfect marriage. And what about perfection? You don't have to work on it. So this was just 3 years away. It's okay. And when after this 3 years is over, we're going to get right back to where we were before and everything's going to be fine. Because you see, I knew that things weren't, that we weren't as close as we had been. But I was tired, and those 12 hours at home, I mainly wanted to sleep, because in those 36 hours at the hospital, I was lucky to get 2 hours sleep. And things were okay. Things were going to be okay, because when you have the perfect marriage, you don't have to work on it. Till one night I came home to a darkened apartment. At that point, our oldest daughter, Ray, was probably about a year old. And she was asleep in her room. And I walked into Christy's room, and all the lights were out, and I walked into our bedroom, and she was curled up on the bed crying. And I knew something awful had happened. And I thought maybe her parents had been killed in an airplane crash or something like that, awful had happened or something of this. And I didn't know what it was. I said, "Sweetheart, what's wrong?" And she began to tell me of the story of her addiction to the drug Percodan, a prescription drug that she'd become addicted to. And she'll tell you her view of that night. And what she'll tell you tomorrow is that she thinks that somehow through my father's recovery from in AA, that somehow I knew that there was hope for her. But I just think I was just dumb and in denial. Because what I told her was, everything's going to be okay. I hugged her and I loved her and I said, everything's going to be okay. And I sat out the next morning and went to the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical School, asked him for the best psychiatrist in addiction medicine in the city of Dallas, Texas, made Christy an appointment with him, and I had taken care of that problem and was ready to go on to the next. Problem solved. My stepmother, my father was dead by this time, but he had married a beautiful woman in Alcoholics Anonymous, Lillian Miller. And Lillian, Christy called Lillian several months later because somehow Christy didn't think things were going quite well in her life. And Lillian came out to visit us, and when she got out there, she decided that we ought to go to some meetings of AA and Al-Anon. And I said, fine. I'd always done everything I was supposed to do, and if I was supposed to go to Al-Anon, I'd go to Al-Anon. And so we went to my first Al-Anon meeting. And they came up and they said, oh, your wife has a drinking problem. Well, let me... All right. I was asked to come here and share my own experience, my own strength, and my hope, okay? So this is my story, all right? They came up to me and they asked me to, they came up and said, so your wife has a drinking problem? I said, no, I don't have any problem with her drinking at all. It's just these drugs. Drinking's never been a problem. And they patted me on the back and said, keep coming back. And my experience is, I'm glad they did. I'm glad they didn't say, we don't like your kind here. There's another place for you. You can go someplace else. They just patted me on the back and said, keep coming back. All right. And that was about April of 1979, when I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. And in July of 1979, Christy and I came back east When you're in Texas and you come back south, they call it back east. So we came back east. And we were in North Carolina, and we were looking for places. It was about a year before I was going to be finishing up my residency, looking for places in order for us to set up what we hoped would be our lifelong home. And we were looking at places in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, and doing this. And while we were in North Carolina, Christy's brother lives in Charlotte and had a home there. And while we were there, we had no money, so of course we were going to stay at the place where it cost us nothing. And we went to stay with a brother in Charlotte. The first night, he was not there. He was not home. And so we were there by ourselves, which was fine. But that night, Christy began to act strangely. Her balance was not exactly steady. Her words were slightly slurred. Her thought processes were not sharp and distinct. Some of the things she said made little sense to me. And by this time, you understand, I had 4 years of medical school, 2 years of rigorous specialty training, and immediately I went through the differential diagnoses and realized that she had had a slight stroke or acute Alzheimer's disease. Not wanting to embarrass her or myself, I did not mention any of these symptoms to her. Made careful note of them, with plans to go back as soon as we got back to Dallas and go directly to the chairman of the Department of Neurology. I always went to the top, chairman of the Department of Psychiatry, chairman of the Department of Neurology, described these symptoms to her so that we could figure out what was going on. Went to sleep that night, somewhat concerned, woke up the next morning, and none of the symptoms of the previous night were present. She had seemingly returned to normal. And I began to think that perhaps this was a transient ischemic attack, which is a stroke that almost happened but didn't. And during the day, everything seemed to be fine. Her brother came home that following evening, and after he came home, it got to be about 5 o'clock, and he said, "Well, would y'all like to have a drink?" And as I said, I was going to Al-Anon, but I didn't have any problem with Christy drinking, because drinking had never been a problem. And she said yes, and I said yes, and he said yes, and we had a couple of drinks. Well, perhaps more than several, but as a few drinks got into Christy's system, I began to recognize the symptoms of the night before. And I thought, she was drunk last night. You see, but it had never occurred to me she was drunk because we weren't drinking. And it had never occurred to me that she would be drinking by herself. And I knew that alcohol was a problem. I knew that alcohol was a problem. And I went back and started going to those Al-Anon, continued to go to the Al-Anon meetings as I had before, but with the realization that alcohol was a problem. And I look back in those times, and I guess that what kept me coming back to the Al-Anon was the grace of God. I had every reason not to go. I did. I still had an extremely busy schedule. It was difficult time. I was tired. I didn't have much time. I had every reason to think, I don't have time to go to these meetings. Christy was going to AA, and it wasn't working for her. She was still drinking and going to meetings. There were no men in the group. I was the only man, so that I could have used that. And I was a lot smarter than those ladies were in Al-Anon. Certainly seemed that way to me. And, you know, so when people say, "Well, why did you continue to go back?" And I think it was just the grace of God kept me going. Because I don't really have any other answer. Yeah. But I did continue to go, and I'm grateful for that. While we were in Dallas, some interesting thing happened. We were at a meeting that called the family afterward there. Jerry Jehu, he's speaking tomorrow night, was here. There's Jerry. Christy told me you were here. Good to see you. And he and his wife, Billy, were part of that meeting and the family afterward. And we started one in Columbus. It's a mixed AA and Al-Anon open discussion group. And both the AA literature and the Al-Anon literature say that's okay. It can't be a group, but it can be a meeting. And we had this meeting, and I love that because I always kind of liked the AAs at that time better than the Al-Anons anyway. You know, I was still pretty sick. And, that I got to share. And one night we were talking about humor in the program, laughter in the program. You know, and it really is kind of crazy. I told a few jokes at the beginning, but you know, the laughter and the humor in the program is odd. You know, because the speaker gets up and they talk about all these terrible things that happened to them, and this happened and that happened, and the car, you know, and everybody laughs and laughs about all these terrible things that happened. And then they get up here and start talking about how good it is today, and everybody cries, you know. It's odd. Well, that night we were talking about humor in the program, and it got my turn to share. And I thought I was going to be particularly brilliant that night because you see this idea of tragedy and comedy. And so I spoke that night on the difference between tragedy and comedy with reference to the ancient Greek playwrights, with some particular references to Euripides. Very enlightening. And I left the meeting feeling very, very good until this woman in Al-Anon came up to me afterward and she said, "Jim, we are here to share our own experience, strength, and hope, not our education. If you don't have any experience, strength, and hope, don't say anything." I still have a resentment against that woman. Now, she is absolutely right. Absolutely right. And it's something that I try to remember whether I'm sharing in my home group or whether or not I'm sharing it my story behind a podium like this, to try to remember to share my own experience, my own strength, my hope, because that's what I have to offer you. You know, that's the very best gift I have, is me. It's all I really have, is me. And when I can share me with you up here, that's the most loving thing that I can do for you and for me. You know, and that's what love, that's what loving and being loved is about, is being able for me to share with you and for you to be able to share with me. You know? And that's why, I guess that's the reason why when someone asks me to speak like this, I do it, because it's a way of loving. Because it's not a monologue. It's not a speech. It's an occurrence. Because what you give to me as I stand up here looking to your faces is more important than what I give to you. And what, just kind of that sense of whether or not it's somebody sharing with me afterward. You know, John said something about feel free to welcome us. But you know, it's a wonderful thing is after I share some of me with you, or hopefully me with you as best I can, and you feel like you know me, then what will happen through the weekend is people will come and share some of themselves with me. What a gift. You know, what a gift. It's one of the reasons why it's nice to be able to do it on Friday morning. Number one is I get over and get it over with. And number two is I feel like I know you and you feel like you know me. And that's a real gift. That's loving and being loved. So yeah, I'm real grateful to that woman for what she said to me, you know, that night. She was absolutely right. I didn't get well immediately, because you see, I had this problem. Because I would go to the meetings and listen to people talk about how they used to hunt for bottles, and then I'd go home and hunt for bottles because I've never done it before. You know, I just came to Al-Anon for 2 months and never hunted for a bottle. I'd never done it, you know. So I'd have to sit there and listen to all the crazy things that you used to do back before Al-Anon, and I'd have to go home and do them, you know. You know, yeah. Yeah, I remember one time Bob and Carol were on their way over to the house. We had an apartment in a big apartment complex, and looked through looked through the window, and Bob and Carol were walking that way. And I said, "Christy, Bob and Carol are coming. That's great." And Bob was a fellow resident of mine at Parkland, and he and they were on their way over. And I said, "They're coming to visit us," because they wouldn't have been walking over for any other reason. And I said, "That's great." I said, "You know, we never have anybody over at the house anymore." I said, "This is just wonderful." And Christy said, "I don't want to see them." I said, "Well, we don't have much choice. They're on their way over here." And she said, "I don't want to see them." I said, "Well, they're going to come to the door, knock on the door. We don't have much choice." And she says, "We can go in the hallway, close the door. They won't be able to see us. And then they will go away if we don't answer the door." And, you know, that's exactly what happened. Yes, we went and hid in the hallway, closed the door. They rang the doorbell, and they eventually went away. Now, for Christy, that was reasonable, rational thinking. She knew what she wanted. She didn't want to see these people. She devised a plan to carry that out, and the plan worked. Okay? I was hiding in the hallway, and I wanted to see them. You know, some people are sicker than others. We eventually moved to Columbus after I finished up my residency there, to Columbus, Georgia, and that's where we lived ever since. Christy was still drinking. We were still going to AA and Al-Anon. As soon as I got to Columbus, I joined the Star Mount group, went visited around, and started going to the Star Mount group, and that's continued to be my home group since that time. About 6 months after we moved to Columbus, Christy got sober, and it was a wonderful time. 1981, Christy got sober. And we had 3 years of just wonderful sobriety. It was just wonderful. We had had our second child during that time. We went around to a lot of conventions. Lillian, my stepmother, who we called our other mother, was just a beautiful lady. She would have been the state secretary for the Georgia Assembly, and she knew everybody in Georgia in AA, and she knew everybody in the Southeast in AA, I think. And she took us around to conventions like this, and she introduced us to everybody. You know, she introduced us to everybody and this and that. And I mean, it was just wonderful. It was just wonderful. We met people. It was lovely. And after about 3 years of that, I began to get sick again, because I began to suspect that Christy was drinking. And I didn't tell anybody. I didn't say anything about it at my group. I didn't say anything about it to my sponsor. I had a sponsor, but I wasn't using him. And I began to just play this over my head. I was worried and worried and more worried. You see, but I couldn't tell anyone, because what if I were wrong? How could I accuse her of drinking again and I might be wrong? Accuse her of drinking again. Does that sound like that I believe this is a disease? But that's how it felt. How could I accuse her of drinking again? I might be wrong. And I don't like being wrong. Yeah. I heard someone say something one time that has described me, thank goodness, less today than it used to, but I expect it's applicable more often today than I'd like to admit. As somebody said, you'd rather be right and unhappy than wrong and happy. Yeah. What if I were wrong? And so I didn't talk about it. And I just finally got sicker and sicker. And so finally, one day I sat Christy down and I said, Christy, I've got to talk to you. Because you see, I suspect that you've been drinking again. And I've really gotten crazy about it. And I know this has to have affected the way I react to you. And you have to have known that something has been wrong with me and the way that I react to you. And as I remember that conversation for an hour and a half, we talked about my sickness, my problems, my fears. And I never asked her if she'd been drinking. And she never said one night she'd been drinking. But I told her that I would be talking about it with my Al-Anon friends, because I needed some help, because I was going crazy. And I have to thank the program of Al-Anon for allowing me to do that. Yeah, because I did not at the time, at that point, at least I did not accuse her. I didn't ask her, because you see, the problem was me. The problem was me. Yeah. My problem was me. Now, soon after that, Christy admitted that, yes, she was drinking, and I was right, you see, but that wasn't my problem, whether or not she drank or not. My problem was my reaction to all of that. Yeah. That's what was getting me sick. And over the next 2 years, Christy had some dry times and she had some drinking times, but she didn't have any sober in recovery times. She continued to go to meetings and I continued to go to meetings, and she was in and out of treatment and in and out of hospitals. And I'm grateful for those 2 years, because I learned a tremendous amount, and it was a tremendous time of personal growth for me. Now, every time I say that, Christy, y'all hear her tomorrow. I don't tell her story, but she'll tell you the same thing. But she learned that. But whenever I say that, you know, I had 2 years of great personal growth through that. She says, "Yeah, and the next time you need to grow, you're going to have to get drunk." I'm not doing that for you again. But I learned a lot during that time, because in those first 3 years, it was Christy and me in the program. And during these next 2 years, what I had to learn was what our Al-Anon says that we can be happy whether the alcoholic is drinking or not. And that's what I learned during that time. I could be happy whether the alcoholic was drinking or not. About this time that this was all going on, a guy asked me to be a sponsor. Isn't that the way it always works?
Yeah.
Just when I needed somebody, somebody asked me to be their sponsor. And Sam and I spent a long time together, a lot of time together. And I was real grateful for that time that that Sam and I spent, because he was a tremendous help to me during that time. And our relationship grew, and we saw each other quite often. And I would I'd pick him up, and we'd go have lunch two or three times a week, or times we didn't have lunch, I'd see him after work. And Sam owned his own business, and he was pretty much free to come and go as he pleased. So I'd give him a call whenever I got finished up seeing patients, and we'd go out and have lunch in the afternoons. And Christy and I was in marriage therapy for about a year of this period, and so we had marriage therapy every Thursday, and then Sam and I always played tennis afterwards so that I could debrief. And one day I was riding along, and I thought, all of a sudden, I'm driving this guy crazy. I'm calling him all the time for lunch. I'm calling him to go have coffee. I'm making him play tennis with me every Thursday afternoon. I bet this guy is so sorry he ever asked me to be his sponsor. I think I better wait, call him, and wait and see what happens. And something about me said, no, Jim, that's not fair. And then I had to have the courage to talk to Sam and tell him the way that I felt. And he said, well, Jim, I'm glad you didn't do that, because you see, I can usually get away any time. Of course I depend on you to call me. It's your schedule. He says, but if you had not called me, I would have wondered what had happened. And I had to look at that. You see, what I really realized is at that point, I didn't think I deserved a friend like Sam. I didn't think that anyone who knew me as well as Sam did would want to spend that much time with me. He couldn't like me that much because I had let him know who I was. And I had to learn a new layer of recovery. I'm beginning to look at some of that as to who I am and how I feel about myself, and trying to heal that. You see, this thing of loving and being loved, quite often we forget that another way that's been said by several different religious leaders, not just the one that we most commonly look at it, says, love thy neighbor as thyself. We always hear the love thy neighbor, but we forget that that just as important, in order to be able to love our neighbor, we have to be able to love ourselves. And if I don't really feel like I'm worthwhile, how can I respect and love that other human being just because they are a fellow child of God just like me? Really grateful to Sam for that time that he spent. It was during this time that that God spoke to me. Now, I'm not schizophrenic, not psychotic, but God spoke to me. It was as clear as if I heard voices. I was riding down a street in Columbus. It was this time of year because it was right before Thanksgiving. And I'd taken Thanksgiving off because the family was going to go spend the holidays with my mother. But Christy was in the hospital at this point. He was not going to be able to get a pass to go. So I decided to call off the trip and to stay in town. And besides, I had all this paperwork piled up on my desk. And this was going to be a good time to catch up on all that paperwork. And I was in there, and I was on this beautiful sunny day, leaves rustling in the streets and everything. I had the sunroof open, and I was going into work. All right, to get rid of all this paperwork that had piled up. And all of a sudden, I heard this voice, God's voice, and God said, Jim, have fun. What a loving father. The only two words that God has ever spoken to me so clearly was, have fun. Reminds me of that sentence in the AA big book that all of our 12-step programs are based on. It says we absolutely insist on enjoying life. Heard a speaker one time, and he said that when we got to heaven, that he felt like that God, that whoever met us there, whether that was St. Peter or Buddha or Muhammad or whoever was going to meet us there, wasn't going to meet us there with a book and tell us all the things that we had done right and all the things that we had done wrong. But the first question he was going to ask was, did you enjoy the wonderful life that your Creator gave you? That's our gift, life. What are we going to do with it? Yeah. You know, what a loss of the wonderful gift that God has given us of life unless we use it wisely. And part of that life is enjoying life. Yeah, that doesn't mean that every minute of every day that I have is fun and enjoyable. Yeah, but life should be enjoyable. Yeah. And I try to remember that each and every day. I took Christy to a Willing Way hospital eventually after she'd had several hospitalizations at another hospital. And I took her to Willing Way Hospital in Statesboro, Georgia, into the care of a member of our fellowship of Al-Anon, Dr. Al M. And we shared that night as I left Christy there. And he told me about the alcoholism, the addiction in his family. Al's a member of Al-Anon. He's never, I tell this story with his permission. And how every member of his family was active alcoholics, and how painful that had been, parents, brothers, sisters. But he said his little sister and her addiction was what had been the most painful to him, because at one point he realized that despite all of his medical expertise and knowledge of addiction, that she might die and there was nothing that he could do about it. I had a person in the program with me that night, and as we drove home, I remember crying most of the 4-hour way home. Because you see, that night is the night that I really realized that Christy could die of her disease and there was absolutely nothing I could do about it. You know, I knew people died of alcoholism. I'd read the obituaries. I'd been to the funerals of people who had been in AA once, gone out and drank again and died. I'd had patients who died. I'd had friends who died. But you see, that wasn't my wife. My wife was going to recover. And it was that night that I really realized that she could die and there was nothing I could do about it. And I believe it was that point that I really took the first step, that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. Yeah, and I could put her in the hospital, but I couldn't keep her there. She tried to take her life in that hospital. I couldn't prevent it even while she was there. And that's painful, to see my powerlessness and my unmanageability of my life. Christy got sober and recently celebrated her ninth AA birthday. And the last 9 years have been a time of joy. Yeah. Been a time of pain, been a time of sorrow. But throughout it all, we've had people like you in the program who have helped us through it. We have, I believe that both my recovery, Christy's recovery, and our family recovery is in a different plane than it was before during those first 3 years, because of the lessons that we both learned during that time of relapse. You know, I like to bring up the subject of relapse in my home group now. You know, I don't remember that we used to talk about it. And we talk about it now every once in a while, because if nobody else brings it up when it's my turn to chair, I'll bring it up. And we'll talk about our relapse of Al-Anon's and how can we respond to that, the relapse of the others. Because you see, one of the things that some people say is, they say, oh, well, my alcoholic's been sober for so many years, but you know, I don't know what I'd do if they drank again. And I say, well, I know. I'm one of the lucky ones. I know. I know Al-Anon works even if my loved one drinks again. You know, I'm one of the lucky ones. I know. As you see, during that time, you know, I had in the second step, you know, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And my sanity was, is that as long as I had a God of my understanding and was attempting to do His will in my life as best I could, that I would be okay. I didn't know that Christy was going to be okay. I didn't know that we were going to be okay. But I knew that I was going to be okay. But I'm still a sick Al-Anon. I tend to look at this from the positive aspect. Other people can look at it from the negative aspect. It really doesn't matter. This is just the way it is. So, you know, Christy was sober, so I decided, well, you know, we need to have some other people in the family around who aren't sober, you know, so we can have a little fun around here. You know? And so we began to have some other alcoholics who became members of the family, some for long periods of time, some for short periods of time. Some of them got sober, some of them didn't. But people who were brought into the love of our family, some more, some less. Charles was a young man of about 35 years of age. He'd been alcoholic since his early 20s. And Charles had he'd been in and out of treatment centers, detox, hospitals, psychiatric wards. And he'd come back and he'd get sober and he'd do pretty well. He'd go to some AA meetings and he'd get a job. He could always make some money, and after about 2 or 3 months he'd have some money, and then he'd usually get so busy working that he'd stop going to his meetings and he'd get drunk again. And eventually, you know, the times of working became less and less, and the times of drinking became more and more. And when things were going well, he'd drink the Chivas, and when things weren't going well, he'd drink Sterno, literally. And his family had a little money, but his family had long ceased had anything to do with him. His wife and his children had moved away and divorced. And his parents, who had some money, they bought him a little shotgun house down on the banks of the Chattahoochee River so that at least he'd have a roof over his head. He had very little to do with him otherwise, and hoped he didn't burn that down. And when Charles would get drunk, he'd call us up. And, you know, if I answered the phone, he'd talk to me. If Christy answered the phone, Charles would talk to her. You know, it'd be 2 o'clock in the morning, and he was really a lot better than a lot of people drunk sitting there drinking, because he really wouldn't stay on long, about 5 minutes, you know. That's about all but usually somebody calls me drunk, you know, I usually have to end the conversation with them, you know. But Charles wouldn't spend a lot of time, but he'd get calling, he'd just say, I'm dying, I've got to do something. I'll do anything you say, what do I need to do? And I'd just say, you know, Charles, come by the office tomorrow and we'll talk. Most rarely would he show up. We can get a call another week or 2 weeks later, a month later. One night as I was leaving the hospital, there Charles was waiting by the door. He said, Jim says, I got to do something. He says, I'm going to die. I'll do anything you say in order to get sober. And I said, well, I don't know what you're doing tomorrow, but tonight you're coming home with me because I'm ready to go home. He said, no, I can't do that. No way. Look at me. You know, he's filthy, dirty. And I said, no, you said you'd do anything. I'm going home. There's dinner at home. I'm ready to go home. And you're going to come home with me tonight. We'll decide what you're going to have, what you're going to do tomorrow. And he didn't want to come, but I essentially made him do it. Got on the car and peed on the car seat on the way home. Do you know that dries? Showered, and I gave him an old sweatsuit of mine, a clean sweatsuit, because he was filthy. And he put that on, and we put him in the guest room for the night. And I introduced him to Jessica and Katie and Ray, and we put him to bed. And I got up the next morning, and I was just going to take him in. And I got the next morning doing my meditation, and had kind of gotten him up, and he eventually kind of roused. And I heard him walk by through the living room, because I was on my knees by my chair where I usually say my prayers in the morning, and he was going into the back bathroom, and came back through, and I let him wear those clothes, and I said, well, I'll put you on a bus, and we'll send you over to the VA, and you know, if you want to get sober, you can go through detox over at the VA, and I'll buy a bus ticket for you. And he said, well, I got to go by my place first. He says, I tell you what, let me go back by my place, and then I'll come back by the office this afternoon. And I figured I wasn't going to see Charles that day, and I let him go. But it was soon after that he called back, and he asked me, he said, Jim, and I didn't see him, you know, he didn't go. He said, Jim, when you were on your knees in the living room that morning when I stayed over at your house, he said, you were praying, weren't you? I said, yes. He'd say, people actually do that, don't they? And I said, yes. And he said, you know, I've been going to AA for 10 years off and on, and I thought people only talked about that. I didn't know they really did it. And he said, Jim, he said, you introduced me to your daughters like I was somebody. You let me stay in your home like I was somebody. You know, I knew I couldn't get Charles sober. But I could give him the respect and the love that everyone deserves simply because they're a fellow child of God. You know, and after that, whenever I talked with Charles, he always remembered that night. That was a highlight of his life. You know? He couldn't have thought any more about that night at my house than I would about a month-long trip in, you know, to Europe. It's a highlight of his life. Yeah, and he didn't get sober. In fact, he died in delirium tremens in a jail because he refused medical care, had a seizure, refused to go to the hospital, and died of his alcoholism. But I like to think that he died, perhaps at least with the thought that yes, there was maybe a little more hope because he knew people. He not only had heard people talk about praying, he'd seen someone pray. And he had a little bit more respect for himself maybe because that night I had done a simple thing like introduced him to my daughters. Yeah. It doesn't take much. You know, that's just an example. Other people have entered our lives. You know, Bobby who's here. Fine young man, sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. Brings a lot of joy and happiness to our lives and our family. You know, a lot of enthusiasm. Yeah. He gave me a poem this morning that he had written, you know, for me, about me. Yeah, what a gift. Yet he's brought so much more to us than I feel like we can give to him. Yeah, but loving and being loved. Yeah. John, who will come up with Ray this afternoon, yeah. You know, just a wonderful gift. Yeah. Had a real stormy relationship in that, John, and there are times when he tried to pull away and come back, you know, and I had a real hard time saying, you know, well, is this what I ought to do? Is this God's will for me? You know, should I open up my house, continue to open up my house to this young man? Yeah. But something said that, yes, I should, you know. And part of that held me back was simply my own, I don't have enough to give. I'm not good enough. I'm not worthy. I don't, you know, who am I to think that I have something to give to someone else? What is this? And somehow God gave me the courage to continue to do that. Gave Christy the courage to continue to open our hearts and our lives. Loving and being loved. And I think that in one part of my life I kind of looked at love as there was a certain amount of love and you had to give it out to people. You know? Gave so much to your wife and so much to your children and so much to my parents and so much to brothers and sisters. And at one point, you know, if you gave a little bit more to somebody, then you had to take some away from somebody else, you know? Yeah. That's not the way I found it in my life. What I found is that the more I love any one person, the greater my capacity is to love someone else. That's the way I found it. That's been my experience. And the amazing thing is that the more I love others, the more I am able to perceive and appreciate their love for me. And with that has come a tremendous amount of serenity and peace in my life. We talk about serenity in the program a great deal, and I remember to me today, serenity has best meaning by going back to my childhood, a little song in my childhood that describes it best. Because, you know, somehow I used to think that serenity was kind of complete and total calm or peace, but I don't believe that anymore. I believe that serenity. Yeah, because you know, I used to kind of figure out, you know, how I felt. You know, I was supposed to feel one way or feel another way, or am I angry, or am I sad, or am I calm, or all this. And today I believe that what emotional maturity is to be able to have several different emotions at the same time and be okay with that. Yeah, I can be angry and sad at the same time. I can understand why Christy is acting the way she is and be angry at her for acting that way at the same time. I don't have to figure it out. I can have both in doing that. And what serenity is something that sits way down at the bottom, making all of that okay. Making all of that okay. I remember driving in my car one time and I was in a lot of pain for someone who was going through a painful time and I had a lot of pain and I was concerned about them. And I was crying. And it suddenly occurred to me as I said, thank you God, that I can cry. Thank you for giving me the capacity to care this much. Because see, I remember walking across the Duke University campus one time and this thought hit my head, if my mother or my father were to die, would I care enough to cry? I did not sure I had the capacity to care enough to cry, to feel truly sad at that loss. Yeah. So surrender today is not lack of pain. It's not feeling anger. Serenity is something that stays deep down inside. And in that little song that I learned when I was in a little Methodist church in Manchester, Georgia, the first verse of which goes, "There's a joy, 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 joy down in my heart." And the last verse of which is, "There's a peace that passeth understanding down in my heart." That's how I understand serenity. Despite all of these other emotions that I can be feeling, there's a peace that passeth understanding. I don't understand it. I know it's just there. But yes, as long as I work these 12 steps, go to my meetings, work with others, try to be honest in all my affairs, have a relationship with the God of my understanding, that I'll be okay. I want to close with a prayer that I always close with, particularly appropriate for today's and this weekend because of the theme. It's a prayer that was written by a man named Francis who lived in a little hilltop town in Italy called Assisi. And I really had the wonderful opportunity to visit that town and visit the church that he probably wrote this in. And if you would, if you'll kind of join me in with this, if you want to bow your heads and close your eyes, that's fine. If you want to look up toward the heavens, if you want to just look ahead, but if you'll just join me in whatever way you choose. And I will close with this. Lord, make me an instrument of Thy peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. And where there is sadness, joy. O Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive, it is in pardoning that we are pardoned, and it is in dying that we are born to eternal life. Today I understand eternal life a little differently than I used to. I don't think it's anything about golden streets or pearly gates necessarily. Eternal life is something that I'm right smack dab in the middle of today, living one day at a time. Thank you.